Hey, boys. Hey, B-Z. Yeah, B-Z down, boy. That you, Bo? Welcome back to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show. Sunday evening, May 13th. That's Sunday evening. Yes. I hope you enjoyed the Saturday night show. That was a lot of fun doing that. And, of course, we're up in San Francisco this weekend. And but we're getting the shows out. We're down to about the last hour and 15 minutes or so of the seminar series. So I'm going. I set it back about a minute from last week. And so we won't miss anything. So without a whole lot of goofing around, as it would be, we're going to start this thing up. Welcome, Tampa Bay. Welcome, all my above the ground, under the ground, sideways listeners in all the different countries all over the world. Here we go.
And the proper radiations are readministered back into the body as they're written up or are designed on the computer to do so from the data bank. So if the person, let's say, is low in orange, we give them a huge amount of orange energy. If they're low on red, we give them extra red energy, and plus all the sounds and colors and everything else that goes along with it. The X1, depending on how powerful the radiations are, can be adjusted. And so the X1, because of its design and its integrity, can rearrange the molecular structure of the body within seconds. So if it might have taken the body normally, let's say, 2 weeks to perform this healing that was necessary to bring this person back around into proper alignment, the X1 would be able to do it in a minute or two. There are more crude forms of this equipment on the planet. For example, in Germany, there's a company over there that makes moray therapy equipment. And let's say, for example, that you had a shoulder pain. The shoulder, you know, the proper frequency for muscular contraction in the body without pain would be something under 18 cycles. If the body starts receiving too much electrical stimuli from an outside source and starts getting more alternating currents into the muscular portions of the body, the motivator centers, the body ends up lodging too many frequencies. It's like an overcharged battery, and the result is pain and blockage in that shoulder portion. So you end up with maybe a 19 or 20 or 21 hertz electrical stimuli response pattern in that particular area of the body. What the more therapy equipment does, stimulate the body. It first of all, it measures the body, what frequency the body is actually at. And let's say you've got it measures 21 hertz or 20, the motor reaction of 21 hertz in the shoulder section of the body. Well, this is 3 hertz higher than it should be. So what it does is it samples the 21 hertz in one side of the body, conditions it down to 19.5 hertz, sends it back into the other side of the body, which then lowers the 21 to 19, you know, the 21 maybe down to 20, and then it samples again at say 20 and a half, and then sends the difference frequency back into the body, and continues on this way until the body is gradually lowered to 18 hertz. This type of equipment, I don't know, it's not legal in this country to use professionally for therapy, but it does exist worldwide. And these are the kinds of technologies that the X1 is capable of encroaching, and it can actually go far beyond that because we're not just using a AC stimulating, lowering, oscillating pulse technique. We're also using an optical hydrogen venom activating pulse technique, which is far more sophisticated. There's many other things that the X1 can do, and I'll cover some of these things briefly as we go further into this, but this is just like an entertaining idea or thought of what this kind of technology is about. It also generates a complete set of scalar wave frequencies, too. Now I'm going to talk about time a little bit and time travel. One of the biggest, I guess, nuisances that I get in phone calls is people look at our catalog and see, and they want to order or talk about the T7 time travel transposer that I constructed a number of years ago here in Paradigm. It was a large vehicle that was about 30 feet tall and about 15 feet wide, because Semyasi told me that later on when we got into the propulsion research that it would be good to understand time travel, because to get lost in time is one area of concern. To get lost in space is another area of concern, but to get lost in space and time is a major area of concern. And I didn't listen to her. She told me to build this time machine at, with a 12-foot base diameter. I mean, a 10-foot base diameter, and I built it at a 12-foot because I had computed I'd get a little extra space inside of it. And when I found out this extra 2 feet that I had down there that she told me not to, I ended up with a vehicle that was so large it wouldn't even fit in the backyard. It ended up extending over the edges of the fences and out into the next yard. And it created too much energy and completely disrupted the neighborhood. The city didn't like it a whole lot either. And, but luckily I was able to do some lobbying with the local mayors who liked it for a couple of successive chains of mayors. But then finally a regime came in, and because we didn't have a building permit for a time machine, we had to tear it, take the thing apart. But it was interesting. It created a vortex around one of the trees in the backyard that would show visitors when they come. And if you look at a landing track, like in some of the photographs that Billy Myers took in Switzerland, where you can see the actual impressions in the ground left by a Pleiadian ship and what it does to vegetation where the landing pods sit. After a period of a year, you have another, the brush is still growing kind of in a circular clockwise motion, and even 2 or 3 years later, there's still a disturbance in the growth patterns because of the way the DNA frequencies are affected by the energies of the ship. Well, the time machine did the same thing in my backyard. It created the same kind of vortex to things growing around it, and one of the surviving things is this huge giant tree that was a sapling when it was planted as a pine tree, which normally goes straight and majestic, and this particular pine tree is growing in swirls and counter swirls, all in clockwise swirls and motions, and it looks like a giant landing track sticking out of the ground, so you have to see it, but then seeing is believing, and it's still there as physical hard evidence today. But getting back to my concern about people's inquiries, first of all, to get into this type of construction and this type of technology with the methods that are available today on Earth is incredibly expensive, and most people have no idea of the unfathomable cost that it costs even to construct partial prototypes to demonstrate the phenomenon. If anybody out here listening to this tape decides they want to build a time machine, you better have a cool $1 million set aside just to build a rough model working prototype, and that one probably won't fly. The next generation that we build will probably be a flying unit, and that'll probably cost another $2 or $3 million. The reason that we would need to build a flying unit is because when you go backwards in time, the terrain oftentimes changes. And so when the vehicle, because it's large size, comes to rest in time at some particular point in time, if the terrain is changed, then what's going to happen is when it locks down into the third dimension, it's going to fall over or be embedded inside of a cliff or a whole multitude of things that could happen to it, whereas if it's a few miles above the surface of the Earth before it makes its time travel transposition, then what happens is it doesn't matter, but it's not subject to the changes in the terrain. Now, getting into some of the basic ideas of what time is all about, if you remember back when I read out of Death of Ignorance and some of the other areas, if you go back and study what I said about time, you should have a pretty firm understanding at this point in time about time and how it's created. If you remember, I talked about the energies from the inner space and outer space colliding in the third dimension. So the inner space energies, outer space energies, when they come together, create the frequency of time when it's modulated by mind. So that means that, for example, tradition would be a modulating, motivating factor of mind. Mind has to be motivated to modulate. Of course, the first thing that would modulate or motivate mind to modulate the inner collision energies of space, inner space and outer space, would be the fact that you're in a physical incarnation, and you wouldn't want to be the only one in physical incarnation inside of a particular space.
This seminar series is continued on the other side.
Oh, we're going to pop this next tape in now. And like I say, we're coming up to the very end. The end of the seminar, we got about an hour left here, actually, and it's interesting to get into this time travel stuff. There'll be a lot more on the RaysOfTruth.website, RaysOfTruth.tv website on this particular machine that we built a few years ago. And let me see here. Let's see, that's tape 17A. I actually need 17B. So we got to find, maybe we got an hour and a half left here. Let me see if I can't find the right tape here, because we don't want to have the wrong tape in. Here's tape 17B. I guess we got about 2 hours left. Everybody lucked out on that one, huh? There we go. Now we'll start. Almost put the wrong tape in there. We're running this off of that series, and like I say, it was pre-recorded, but saving a lot of money here by getting to hear it on BBS Radio for free. And it's coming right back up. Here we come.
Second thing that would motivate you is not only want to be the only occupant in a particular space and time, but you would also want to have some kind of vehicle that you could express yourself through, i.e. a physical body. This would be another reason to create time. And then, of course, the physical body would have its requirements, oxygen, air, sound requirements, communication ability to navigate, these kinds of things. That would be another reason to create time. And then, of course, once you had created enough time where you could occupy yourself in a world, then you'd obviously want to go about setting up what we would call tradition, which would be the next or the secondary cause of time, meaning that you would develop crafts, you would develop shipbuilding, furniture building, house building, and all these kinds of things until you had a whole lineage of expression on this particular energy field. Then what would happen is if you have built houses and homes and set traditions and style, and you realize that your physical body is probably getting too old to occupy, then you'd probably want to come back and get into a new body. So you create another time where your body, your soul, could go out in limbo long enough for another body for you to be prepared so that you could re-enter into the third dimension and continue on with your traditions and things that you would want to do. So this would be a third reason why you would want to have time. And I think by now you start to get the picture of how time operates. And of course, you know, let's say you're the first person coming out of the involute, or the first expression of God as a physical form, which would have been somebody a long time ago. Then what would happen is once you've created these civilizations, you know, because you want to multiply upon yourself and split your soul down into sub-frequencies, you would create a lot of time and a lot of tradition. And pretty soon you'd be spreading yourself out all over the universe. After at some point in one of your civilizations you created space travel and the ability to do so. So really what I'm saying now is that by tradition we can look back, as Scott Wolf had pointed out earlier, in some of the Vimanas and the other craft that the Japanese had in their Shinto, the space and time travel is nothing new. It's nothing old, nothing new. It's just something that comes and goes depending on the frequency of our society. So obviously we've come to a point in time now in our society where the frequency is such that we're going to have time travel again. Because I've already built a time machine, and we'll build another one fairly soon, as soon as I have a bigger space to build it in and a little bit more time to set about this construction as a project. Right now we have priorities in other areas, but I'm going to share this with you, and if you want to build your own time machine, I'm available on a consulting level to show you how to build your own. I don't really have to build it. Anybody can build one. Now that we have a basic understanding of time, well, I want to clarify one more thing about time. When you have, let's say that you've gotten to be an older being now, and you're one of the first beings on this earth, let's say there's only you and you and Eve, or you and Adam, and it's time for you to leave. Let's say that you got Eve pregnant. Well, if you're a man, well, now what we have here is a summation of two aura fields from the astral plane, Eve and Adam's vibratory frequency, and we've now gotten pregnant, and you leave. So you leave the space, and you come back, and you manifest again as the son of Adam and Eve. The space that you left is the echo field, that the summation field that you created between your interaction with your wife and that. So you go into the astral plane. As you perpetuate more and more and create more and more of yourself and bring your soul out and express it into many other souls, and you end up with an entire, let's say, city of beings. You're the only city on earth at this point in time. Now you form a religion, so that when you can kind of contain your family energy fields within the city. So you start traversing back and forth to the astral plane. Now, the funny thing about it is when you get up on the astral plane and you're out of body and you're out of incarnation, you're still in time. You're in a time field that's created up as a secondary field from the third dimension. So now the time relationship in the fourth dimension is a reaction at this point in time to the field that's put into the third dimension. So you have a third dimension, fourth dimensional interchange. The astral plane, being the auspices or the beginning phase of the fourth dimension, is a higher energy and frequency, and we've already talked about the astral plane, so obviously we realize everything is self-illuminating. So when we bring hard science up to the astral plane, we realize we don't have speeds of light anymore. Everything is instantaneous, so therefore on the astral plane, everything is instantaneous in its energy form. So if everything is instantaneous, then we don't have anything in space. Space doesn't exist in between the third dimension and the fourth dimension. There's zero space. So if we can access this plane between the third dimension and fourth dimension is zero space, that means we can access anything in the universe instantly. So now we have the ability to not only overcome time, but we have the ability to overcome space. And when you have this understanding, then it's very simple to take the time travel, transpose it, and convert it into an interstellar flight machine. So now you begin to understand how the Pleiadian technology works, or the extraterrestrial technology works. Now, the first thing we have to do, getting back to hard basic facts, is to understand what time is. Now, I know everybody wants to jump now, and let's talk about interdimensional, interstellar travel. That comes later in this tape. Right now, we're just talking about time. Okay, if a submarine, first of all, time is like an echo. The only hard place that you're going to go in time travel is into the past. If you go into the future, what you're going to do is you're going to go up into the astral planes, and in the astral planes, you're going to just run into the planning committee that's planning to come back and reincarnate again here and learn again, once again, certain things that weren't learned in the previous incarnation. So for the sake of future time travel, just realize that you're going to go up and meet the planning committee. And the planning committee is always a group of individuals that has already incarnated here, made their mistakes, is up on the astral plane in the religious space, which is timeless, and it has this in relationship to the third dimension, and it is spaceless in relationship to the whole space-time continuum, so you have a bit of freedom up into the fourth dimension. Now, first of all, you got to realize that because the energy is centered on the third dimension and not the fourth dimension, the be here now rule applies. I remember when I tried my second time experiment to go slightly ahead in time, I went right into a black void and found out there was nothing there because everything was timeless. So all the things that are going on are being that we're aware of, that are our reality, are being held together on this plane of consciousness in the third dimension by the mental acuity that everyone has. For example, if someone handed me a table, I'd look at that table and I would immediately realize tradition. It took time to design this table. It took space to build it. It took time to realize the engineering of this table, meaning that if I had put three legs on it, it might have not had the same stability as four, or the strength. If I had put two legs on it, it would have fallen over. And over a period of time, tradition has taught me that four legs serves the best purpose for a table. So this would give me the table some heritage. Then I could look at this table and say, well, this was a Louis the 15th or Louis the 14th dynasty table from France or England, or I could say this is an old German built table because it's very heavy. It was probably built during the times of the Crusades. I mean, there would be something else to look at this table, and I would comfortably be able to relate to human beings being alive on this planet for a period older than myself, because I'm looking at traditional things that have been put together scientifically and mechanically by their experiences. They've knowledgeably moved forward in time. So now here I am in the present. Because if somebody says, well, I want to show you a future table, I'll say, fine. And they're more than likely going to show me a drawing because they haven't created it yet of a concept. So now you get an idea for time. Now, so therefore, if you go into the past, another thing that people ask me about time is, if you go into the past, what change on the present can you make? Well, usually very little, because mass mind is tuned in to being here at the present. For example, today's date is March 22nd, and I'm recording this, 1991. The entire consciousness knows this is March 22nd, 1991, and it's approximately 1:30 Pacific Standard Time is the actual time this is taking place. And everybody's acute to that. Mass mind, if you ask anybody anywhere in the world at this point in time, what this point in time represents to them, they're going to give you a date and a time and a place where they are, and we're going to have a correlation, which is going to give us time zones, depending on whether they're in this latitude, the next one, the next one, the next one. these kinds of things. So this gives you an idea about time. But as far as going back into time, let's say somebody goes back, and I'm going to stop Hitler from doing what he was doing. The moment you jump back to 1938 or 1937 to make this strong move, what happens is you're not in the real time. The real time is already, is now. The Hitler's dynamic, for example, has passed. But you could make a change in the group of energy that's forming the summation of that time and space field that you're in back in 1938. Because there are still memories of people's thoughts of that time, and that memory, what people's experiences are, that memory is holding into space, is holding into place somewhere a dimension whereby the time of 1938 still exists. It depends on how many imaginations that are being affected in the present, how much and how strong and how powerful it is in the past, and what you can do to it. So let's say that you go ahead and make a major change, the assassination of a dark figure or whatever, or maybe the institution of a positive white figure, that somebody that could have made it if they had a chance back then that you're aware of that most people aren't. The fact is, even though you made the change in that point in time, the chances are it's going to echo and reverberate back out through existence. So by the time it gets up to the present, that change, it's already faded out in people's minds, people that were directly involved in the day the change was made. Now, granted, if you took a major figure like Hitler and made a large change, there would be a large echo in the fact of what you had done, but still, the fact is the main mass of energy is in the present, so it still, at some point, would cancel itself out. It would interfere with some of the interdimensional spaces between the present and the past, depending on how far in the past that you made this change. However, if you were to take every single person on the planet Earth and say, all right, everybody, now we're going back into 1938 and make changes, then you could have a monumental effect. And this is, of course, what civilization has to start to begin to deal with when you start encroaching upon the fact that, in reality, we are going into the fourth dimension. So some changes in the present will be possible sometime in the future, but they're not possible yet. Now, the technology of looking in the past is also used on this planet in another way. And that way is that if you had a submarine, for example, moving through the ocean, through the Pacific Ocean, let's say, and you brought a reconnaissance plane out with infrared heat sensing devices 2 weeks past or after the submarine had already gone on its path, you would be able to detect a heat trail from where that submarine was 2 weeks ago because of the way the heat would have affected the ocean and the currents of the ocean. So this is kind of like a residual echo. So this is possible. Now, the next thing I kind of want to get into is to give you an understanding about how time travel is present, how it's achieved, and how to accomplish this. Now, I first got the idea back when I was at the University of Michigan, when we were looking at, with the Wilson Cloud Chamber, we were able to look at particles that were moving at what we call negative times. And when I was able to see these particles in negative times, of course, science was, as I explained earlier, was giving these things half-life periods, which is the rate of decay, by the way, from nuclear energy, but not for the length of time that some of these particles were seeing. If we were able to keep the field up, the energy more consistent, the half-life would have appeared to be a lot longer of these decay of these different radioactive particles. And so as a result, I decided to build a Wilson cloud chamber as large as was necessary to take the human body inside of it and to excite the human body as we had done in exciting particles inside of a nuclear reactor or for example, a Babatron or a cyclotron or a synchrotron. Most of the work that I did was cyclotron in Randolph Labs at the University of Michigan back in the 50s. So anyway, first thing that we did is we began to do a study on the human body and how consciousness and time interbehave, and what I think I've already covered that pretty good in the earlier part. I think some of you that don't understand what I'm saying, you're going to have to review the earlier part of the tape series when I talk about spirit and the struct zone energies and that. I don't have time at this point to go into it. So after reviewing the facts of how time began to work with consciousness, then we began to review the facts of how consciousness reacted to form and how form reacted to the cosmos, get a basic understanding. So having discovered that the basic spirit life ebb force flows in through the upper etheric planes, up through the reflective ether, down into the chemical ether, actually from the light ether to the chemical to the light ether to the reflective ether to the chemical ether, we decided that work with the particles the ones like in the vitality globules, are the particles that were manifesting that were subatomic, that were behaving just before, just after the their creation from the astral plane, their transition, I should say, through the astral plane from the other higher interdimensional planes, and at the transition point whereby they arrived on the physical plane and began to express themselves in the form of some form of gravity. So what we did is we decided to we looked at the laser, and we noticed that the laser was a good example of photons emitting from the astral plane by the excitation of the orbiting electrons around a particular chemical. In this case of the laser, we were using ruby rods, or we use helium neon or helium cadmium. So it was more of the main problem to tackle here was a problem of extracting or interfacing the energy as it actually fed the electron-proton relationship, because as soon as the electron and proton relationship could be interfaced, then we knew that in order to interface it, we would have to go through the subatomic planes. But we also knew that when we did interface it, which would be on the level of electrical precursation, what would happen is immediately electricity and the cellular and biochemical and all the other reactions would follow rather quickly. But we also had to do another thing. We had to, once we got in touch with this space and time where the ethers were working directly onto the physical plane or the physical electron-proton relationship, once we took command of this, we had to make a complete transition of this command. In other words, we didn't have time to wait for, you know, we knew the cells were reproducing at 50 million per second, but we didn't have the time that was necessary to wait for, say, for example, the bone structure, the skeletal structure, the tissue in the body to go through anywhere from 90 days to 7 years to make a transition. In other words, we didn't need a slow-acting time machine that you sit in for 7 years to make a complete transition somewhere else. That was kind of stupid. So what we had to do is we had to get the attention of the body, the cellular system of the body, or whatever else we were going to transpose. We had to get the attention at the most critical point and make an immediate transposition. And this immediate transposition would determine how quick we made it and where we took it to. It would determine where in time we would go into the past or the present or the future or whatever, depending on how we keyed it. If we keyed it in an upward frequency, naturally we're going to go up on the astral plane with it. If we keyed it in a downward frequency, meaning we slowed things down on it, we're going to fall into the present and into the past. So in order to do this, it was necessary to create a modulating device whereby we could use energies to direct the fields into the structure itself. So I did some research on it, and I found that the Möbius pattern was the best candidate to look at the Möbius frequencies. And the idea was then taking a p orbital pattern of an electron around a proton, which I talked about earlier, and I've shown diagrams in Death of Ignorance, create that p orbital pattern into a Möbius pattern, and we should get some kind of result. That was my idea in the very beginning. So that's exactly what we did. We built a huge octahedron, an octahedron, if you remember, is a pyramid right side up and it's a pyramid upside down. So the octahedral shape in itself had a tendency to lend itself towards balance and joint union of the male-female energies, because we were going to have to definitely take into consideration the male-female energies as they were in a static dynamic condition. Then we did is we developed an electrostatic device. We're going to have to move all the protons and electrons simultaneously. We're going to have to push all the free electrons in one direction and all the free protons in another direction to create a stress. In other words, to create a rubber band effect. Because in order to change the electron behavior around a nucleus, we have to get its attention. And the only way you do is you pump energy into it or you pull energy out. In the case of a laser, they're pumping energy in, so the electrons which are lined up to the protons are all stretched out like a rubber band, but they're done in unison or coherently. And as a result, all the electrons fall at the same time, and as a result, they release a photon in phase, coherent light, which is exactly what we were going to have to do. But we didn't want to generate the body and create fourth-dimensional light from the bodies. We wanted to go inside the chain. So what we had to do is extend the electrons out and then make them fall back. But as they fell back, rather than create an exploding energy out from the fourth dimension, we had to create an imploding energy whereby the proton was drawn in to the... So it was almost the backwards reaction of how a laser works, and realize that you're going to be inside of it. So once we arrived upon the shape, around the shape, we constructed a what would be closest thing to it would be described as a Wimhurst machine. And the Wimhurst machine had a has a particular type of switch in it, and this particular type of switch synchronizes the electrostatic, it's called a proximity switch. It synchronizes optically all of the frequencies that are necessary to be generated from the electrostatic forces that are going to be created. The thing that happens is that the person is now put inside of the octahedral structure. Once they're inside the octahedral structure, then we energize the, and approximately the center, then when we energize the outer structure and start the Wimhurst machine going. Once the Wimhurst machine is best described for this experiment, a series of positive plates rotating in one direction, a series of negative plates rotating in the other direction. And by the way, on this time machine, there's very few, if any, metallic parts. We use a lot of plastic, a lot of fiberglass, a lot of wood, a lot of carbon fiber materials, because metal creates eddies and fluxes that aren't necessary, except within the coil windings themselves, where we have in a few places. So then, what happens is you get this huge potential built up being generated by air on the outside of the vehicle that's creating this tremendous positive and negative charge like an electrostatic machine would. Okay, now we have eight sides to this vehicle. We have the pyramid on the right, the pyramid standing up, we have the pyramid upside down. I believe in the slide parts, you know, there's I did a quick photograph of, this, of a model of it. I think I actually might have done a photograph also in the slide, on the video section of this, showing part of the construction, although the Pleiadians asked me not to show too much of the construction of the vehicle. And so what happens is the positive, negative energies are generating a field, and the structure has eight sides. On each eight sides are capacitors. So what you've got to imagine now is a set of capacitors that are built up, the shape of the top, the shape of the bottom. Each capacitor has seven levels deep. These would be like seven plates, seven large plates. It's similar to the Byfield Brown effect. You have seven plates on each of the four sides on the top, and you have seven plates on each of the four sides on the bottom. The shape of the plates is kind of like a triangle. They're insulated with a mylar type material. Now you got to realize that mylar has a tendency to amplify voltage. It's a very interesting thing. I forget the scientific effect of how it works, but it's the same principle that the Grays use in their technology for these little spaceships that the military is working on now. The fact that voltage amplifies over a dielectric, and the way to demonstrate that to yourself, it would be to build yourself a small Jacob's ladder, which was made from a neon sign transformer with two wires coming out. In the neon sign transformer with the two wires coming out, let's say they're each V-shaped wires, approximately 4 inches long. At the top of the V is spaced 3 inches apart, and the bottom of the V is probably 3/4 of an inch apart. The spark will then climb up this Jacob's ladder. You've seen them in science fiction movies. And at the very top, it'll reach about 3 inches in arc, and then it'll disappear and start at the bottom again. It goes zap, zap, this kind of thing that you've probably seen on TV. You could take a Jacob's ladder and extend the wires further up from the transformer, and maybe at the best you might get a 8 or 9 inch spark before the air would hold down, the dielectric of the air would hold down the potential of the ability of the transformer to deliver a spark from one electrode to the other at the end of the Jacob's ladder. So you might be limited to, say, 7 or 8 inches at the top. Now, if you took the Jacob's ladder and made it 30 feet long, just theoretically, let's say, there's no way that the spark was going to go 30 or 40 feet across at the end up there where the bead extends into space. It wouldn't have the potential. But if we put, a 70-foot piece of mylar that's at the right, very thin mylar that's 50 feet or 60 feet high, meaning that it's twice the height of our Jacob's ladder. What will happen is when you turn the transformer on, the spark climb up to the end of the Jacob's ladder through the mylar. It will go across the mylar because the mylar is insulating it, and it'll go all the way up one side of the mylar, which is, let's say, is 30 some 40 some feet go over the top and come back down the other side of the mylar. And so you can theoretically get a 100-foot or a 500-foot or a 10,000-foot spark with it. The mylar has to be thinner to realize the potential. But what happens is you get a planar amplification across the surface that has an effect on electricity, and it also has an effect on gravity. So what you end up with is this very powerful electrical field, electrostatic, electrodynamic field. Even though you started off with an alternating field, you end up with a DC field. And in the process of taking the alternating current and creating it into direct current across this huge surface has an interface on gravity too. And this is how the ceramic systems work in some of these little spaceships that the Grays are using. It's another technology which I'm not getting into right now, maybe later on in the tape. So anyway, we're using that technology to separate the plates, these seven different plates, which are repeated on four different directions on the top and four different directions on the bottom. This repeating pattern gives us a total of 56 plates, 28 on the top and 28 on the bottom. Now these plates are now connected to this generator that generates this negative and positive charge over there, which is like a huge Wimhurst machine around the outside dimensions of the side. So what happens is, when the machine is on, the positive charge will go to one plate, a negative charge will go to another, a positive charge will go to another, a negative charge will go to another. And these are not picked at random, but this is a programmed pattern depending on where we're going in dimension, what dimension, so that we're energizing all these plates. Each one went after the other at a different frequency. We have high-speed switches and proximity switches delivering these energies to these plates. So you can imagine that maybe it's the top plate goes bang, and then a plate on the bottom on the right goes bang, and then one up here on the upper left-hand side and the right-hand side. So you get this pattern of energy, this huge field pattern going all around, and you're in the center of it. Now this field pattern of energy, we're not talking about a capacitor charge of a few microfarads or farads. We're talking more megafarad charges, and we're talking literally millions of volts of electricity moving through here. So you're creating a huge electrostatic field in a pattern, and this pattern, of course, is increased or decreased. On top of the plates discharging and charging all around the entire circumference of the vehicle, and the top and the bottom of the vehicle, there is a frequency, a second frequency that's set up where a scalar wave starts to collapse down on the center of the vehicle, created by the shape and integrity of the plates themselves. The scalar wave is directed directly into the center of the time machine. Down inside the center of the time machine is a column. It's called a cancel column. It's the same thing that exists in a spacecraft. This column exists from the top of the time machine to the bottom of it. It's like you have the two pyramids. Well, there are plates on it, top, you know, two bottoms facing top and top, each pointing in opposite directions, right down through the center. You just imagine a hollow tube. And in this tube is a particular coil that's wound called a caduceus coil. And that means that instead of winding a coil with all the turns in one direction, you wind a coil wound with turns in opposite directions all the way down through the center of it. The center part of this coil itself is hollow. The reason it's hollow is that because there's a large laser that's stationed off to one side, and it has a mirror system that's directed so that its beam will be directed into the center of the cancel column, so that you'll have a beam of light oscillating back and forth, up and down through the center of the vehicle. With outside where the laser is, you're going to have the caduceus coil. And the caduceus coil is taking all the magnetic frequencies and canceling them out into nothing. So what happens is, when you program the vehicle into operation, you get the plate frequencies working their dynamics, which then affects anything that's inside of it, meaning the human being or whatever else is inside of it, so that the electron-proton of the relationship is then disrupted into the whatever is inside the vehicle. And this disruption then has to form a pattern of what this... the pumping frequencies of this proximity switch series of capacitors is all about. At a precise time when the electron-proton structure is completely being interrupted by this frequency, the power is sent up to a critical mass of the outside. In other words, the capacitor plate suddenly triple their energy, it brings the mass inside to a point where it's literally ready to explode. At the point this is done at a critical point, at the same time it wants to explode, the energy is ignited through the cancel column, so all the explosion potential is then canceled into itself, or the electron-proton relationship is basically turned inside out, as the Mobius field is. At the moment that it's turned inside out, the laser discharges inside, and the photon, the laser, by the way, is a contained laser, meaning have 5 and 10x mirrors on it. This laser at the top of the time machine is a 10x mirror. At the bottom of the time machine is a 10x mirror. It builds up to a critical energy, and the outside energies are mixed with the laser frequencies, the laser light itself, and so as a result, the energy is pumped up optically. And so at a critical point, when the whole Mobius field reaches its point where it's turning in, at that moment that it's turning inside out, the laser discharges one time and annihilates the frequencies into the astral plane. And then, of course, at this point in time, the outside Mobius pattern has been twisted inside out. The laser light collapses, the cancel column field collapses, and the outside plates start slowing down in their frequency and vibratory rate. And as soon as they come to rest and there is no more energy coming into these different oscillations, then the vehicle has settled down into its new time frequency and time domain. So as a result, you have made a time transposition.
This seminar series is continued on the next tape.
Well, we're having a lot of fun here. Let's see how we're doing time-wise. 41 minutes, 39. Yeah, I think we'll just stop here for today. Then I can start fresh at the very end on the other one. And I think you are going to enjoy it. So we're down to the last hour. So anyhow, you've been listening to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show at bbsradio.com and Tantalk 1340. AM.com and a bunch of stations around the place. And we're, as I say, this is May 13, 2007. Thank you for listening to the show. And we will be coming back at you next week. We'll have more guests and new stuff and one more hour of the seminar series. So until then, we'll talk to you in a bit. Bye.